In-depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Thanks for listening on Friday, April 12, 2013, on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. It is the Federal News Countdown, as we do every Friday in the 3 o'clock hour. And my experts choosing the most important federal news stories of the week this week are Stan Soloway, the president and CEO of the Professional Services Council, and Frank Reeder. And Frank, every time you're here, I mess this up. Tell me the security organization that you're running to work on cybersecurity issues.
I'm on the boards of two, Center for Internet Security and the National Board of Information Security Examiners.
And it's great to have you here, and I thank you for coming in. You've both chosen terrific stories for the Federal News Countdown. We're going to post them later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And we start where we always do with the third most important federal news story of the week. Stan Soloway, yours is from the Washington Post. The headline is Improving Federal Workers' View of Their Leaders. It's Tom Fox from the Partnership for Public Service writing a column for them. About the best places to work analysis of senior executive service opinions of their leaders. And this conversation, I talked to the gentleman from Deloitte yesterday who did the research for the partnership, and I was struck by how consistent the numbers seem to be split between the broad portion of the federal workforce and the senior executive service. What about this in particular jumped out at you, Stan?
Well, the first thing that jumped out at me is the headline completely contrary to what the story says. I would have read it and said, no. The federal workers have a higher view of their leaders than they did in the past. And if you read the report, it's actually coming down. And that's what struck me is that it's just one of many pieces of the puzzle regarding the federal workforce and where it is and how it's viewing the system within which they have to operate. And, this is a time, with a crisis that we have in government now, fiscal issues, the demography issues, the skills gaps, and so forth. This is about the worst possible time to have a workforce that really doesn't have a lot of faith in its leadership.
The other element that I thought was interesting is the numbers year on year on year among the individual agencies don't seem to move that much. Every year there seems to be one or two agencies that maybe make a pretty big difference. But by and large, if you're at a level, you seem to stay at that level year after year after year after year.
Yeah, it's some of it may have to do with the missions of the agencies and the focused mission of a NASA or the intel community. They're pretty clear where they're going. Others have larger, broader, more diverse missions, or maybe less the driving force behind people coming there than they are in some agencies. But you're right. It does seem like the same agencies year over year do pretty well, and the ones that don't do well are struggling really to get it right.
Now, the mission piece of that, I wonder if you think that might have something to do with the fact that some agencies' missions are very stressful, very complex. I wonder how great a place you can make being a transportation security administrator screener. That's going to be a difficult job no matter what, and so that job's never probably going to score that well, and therefore that agency is going to be difficult for that agency to move the needle.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think also if you even look at the Tom talks about the sort of five or six different keys to effective leadership in his article, and communicating a clear vision, empowering employees, sharing information. Those three, if you think about the mission of NASA, you think about the intel community, I'll use those as two examples, or State Department, they have pretty clear missions. And they've had pretty effective leadership that can pretty clearly identify the vision. There's not a lot of question. You take a DHS, which has 20-plus different agencies merged together. You take a DOD, which has a very clear mission, but there's so many pieces to the mission. I think it begins to break down almost naturally.
Stan Soloway's third most important federal news story of the week is from the Washington Post. The headline is Improving Federal Workers' Views of Their Leaders. Frank Reeder, your third most important story is from Computer World. The headline is DHS Warns of Spear Phishing Campaign Against Energy Companies. And it's remarkable. Every time you and I talk about this, or some of your colleagues in the cyber community, I am always scared and shocked at how sophisticated spear phishing attacks become. These are the emails that you get that pretend that they're coming from someone you know and asking you to click on things to see what it is they want you to see.
Yeah, exactly. It's the distinction here being that phishing is a broadside sent to 1,000 people from Citibank on the chance that, 10% of them may be Citibank customers, mm-hmm. and take the bait. In this instance, it's based on information. The example that is cited in the article is a meeting at which a number of officials of a company, that a number of people at a company attended, referring to that and in turn creating, if you will, a sense that the recipient should have known the person sending it. The larger message here and the reason I pulled it out is, well, I think we are making strides. This isn't a hopeless situation in reducing the impact of spear phishing. The behavioral piece, the social engineering piece, is still critical. Folks, whether you're dealing in your personal life or in your official life, we've got to continue to practice safe computing. If you don't know the person who sent you the email or you're not sure, don't follow the link. Certainly in no instance give out information that would otherwise be privileged, whether it's your password or your social security number.
I'm starting to see some less sophisticated examples of this getting into getting at the personal level. My father-in-law not too long ago was hacked, and there was in the two box, it was me and about 10 or 12 people who I assume are from his address book, and all there was a link in the email. There was nothing right around it. But the first thing I did was hit reply all and say, nobody clicked that link, because I'm sure there was some malware attached to that. But the level of sophistication that we're starting to see in enterprises is even more shocking and disturbing, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I must confess, at the risk of sounding like an economist, I'm of two minds on this. I mean, just as we teach people to drive safely, we can't assume everybody's going to be safe. And so the real
especially
answer,
Soloway. Good gosh.
In particular, I've heard about that. So there are a lot of things we can do and are doing to deal with the consequences of aberrant behavior, whether it's intentional or not. So it's really a war we're waging on two fronts. And clearly, if you do hit that link, you know, and if we send this to enough people, somebody will hit that link. And that link then puts a piece of malware in the system that tries to exfiltrate, that is, extract large amounts of data. We have the tools, although not every organization is using them, to say, hey, wait a minute, folks, there is data flowing out through this port that shouldn't be flowing out. You know, there's water gushing out the door of your house. Hey, maybe we need to shut the water off before we start looking at that, even though – so – you know, it's a good news, bad news story. So we've got to deal both with the automated protections against the consequences of individual error and teach people to behave in a more, shall we say, safer way.
Frank Reeder's third most important federal news story of the week is from Computer World. The headline is DHS warns of spear phishing campaign against energy companies. You can read it later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The second most important story of the week from Frank Reeder and Stan Soloway when we continue on the Federal News Countdown on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Companies and job seekers have tapped into the power of Washington's newest job site, PowerJobs.com. Isn't it time you join them? PowerJobs.com is the new career site made for Washington's top talent, featuring opportunities in the most influential industries that make up our region, including nonprofit, defense, government, finance, energy, healthcare, and technology. Opportunities from employers like K&L Gates, Virginia Hospital Center, and American Hospital Association. New on Power Jobs this week:
Senior Communications Officer Novo Zimes, News Media Outreach Manager Liuna, Cyber Policy Analyst Saitor, Social Media Manager Credit Union National Association, Intelligence Analyst CACI, and Associate Director Minority Business Development Agency. Find these jobs and more at Power Jobs.
Finally, a career site made for you. PowerJobs.com.
The year was 1933, and a 23-year-old engineer named Kelly Johnson was feeling the heat. His bosses at Lockheed Aircraft were betting the future of the company on a new plane, the first to be outfitted with twin engines. What was keeping Johnson up at night was his concern about the stability of the design and what to do about it. Now, after 70 tests in a wind tunnel, he had the answer. Something no one had tried before, Kelly Johnson's twin tail concept for the Model 10 Electra not only stabilized the plane, but also helped usher in a new era in aviation technology. In less than a decade, a Model 12 was flying missions over North Africa, and a Model 14 had flown around the world in record time. The all-metal twin-engine Electra was flying high, and so was Lockheed Aircraft. The Electra story is our story. See it unfold at LockheedMartin.com/100 years.
You're dedicated to your agency's mission. And at Federal News Radio, we're dedicated to making that mission easier. We give you access to the people, policy, and programs that affect you every day from the voices that matter most. Hear for yourself. Florida Congressman Jeff Miller.
Secretary Shinseki has made it clear that this type of wasteful expenditure will not stand. I would expect that we will have hearings on the Hill, possibly in the lame duck session. And without question, this is a complete failure of leadership.
OFPP Administrator Joe Jordan.
In terms of suspension and debarment, this is a really important tool that agencies have to fight fraud, waste, and abuse. It's not a retributive punishment, but it's a way to immediately protect taxpayer dollars.
In your car, online, on the go on your mobile device. Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
The president wants to boost cybersecurity spending next year. I'm Emily Kopp. On Monday's Federal Drive, we'll look at where those billions would go with Alan Paller from Sands Institute. And the Pentagon wants to strip commanders of the power to change criminal convictions. We'll look at the pros and cons with military defense attorney Dwight Sullivan. It all starts at 6 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And for the latest federal news, check out federalnewsradio.com.
This is In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week with the three most important federal news stories of the week, selected by Stan Soloway and Frank Reeder. And we are up to...
Number two!
A little slow on the uptake like I am today. Frank, your second most important federal news story of the week is from the New York Times. The headline is Lobbyists Fighting Spending Cuts Find Ally in Group That Often Backs Them. And this is, I think, a fascinating story because it deals with what goes on behind the scenes in budget negotiations. And it also kind of gives us some insight into how that behind the scenes movement may change based on where we're headed budget wise and dollar wise over the next couple of years.
Yeah. And I threw this in because it was kind of, along with my first story, a small glimmer of hope that says, maybe we can have rational conversations, maybe not in the front room where people are still posturing, but in the back room that says, you know, there are some things in the public space that we need, that we can't continue to disinvest in infrastructure, that we need to continue to support a strong national security posture. And so the fact that folks who would not normally be perceived, at least on the outside, as allies are front or back room talking to one another, I kept looking for positive news stories this week, and this one seemed to offer that.
Do you see something positive here, Stan?
I do, and I think Frank hit on it in a very politic way, as he always does, but I'll be a little bit blunter. I think that in some ways this is a message to certain elements of the Republican Party that have been fighting for defense cuts and against infrastructure spending as a matter of philosophy. And I'm not a member of ACU. I'm come from the other party and so forth, but what they're basically saying is, Frank said, there are some things we actually desperately need to do. And so they're enlisting a political campaign, and you can look at it sort of on the seamy or underbelly of politics. But to Frank's point, there is a division even amongst the wings of each party as to where the money should go. And one of the things that we've been seeing and talking about is you have actually kind of strange bedfellows now emerging on the Hill with a sort of, and I don't mean this in a pejorative sense, sort of the far right and far left, both of whom share a view that we should be reducing defense spending, for example, for different reasons perhaps, but both agree that we should reduce our footprint abroad and so on and so forth. And this is an example where others in the conservative movement are saying, no, that's actually not the right way to go. How they're getting there was really the New York Times point. They weren't taking the more intellectual perspective that Frank was, of course. But
no one can. That's not possible.
This is just turn into a Friar's Roast?
Well, boy, that would be a great show, though. No, but that would be a terrific program sometime.
I love the attention of any kind.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're saying the same things, and the key here is it's a little bit like what happened during the shutdown in 95, that we're actually having a slightly rational conversation in the aftermath of that, of what we need. And while there will always be disagreements on that, at least it's a practical conversation we can have, rather than, and I think Stan said it very well, the sort of theological, no government is good, and all government is good, which seemed to be where we were in the summer of last year.
So what do we expect to see that maybe would build on this and allow more broad coalitions to happen? And you pointed out, Stan, that some of these groups, when they get together, they agree on the end, not necessarily on the means, or sometimes it's vice versa. But I wonder if that's as important as the fact that at least groups who normally don't talk to each other or cooperate with each other are doing so, and so facilitating a dialogue that eventually maybe somebody on the Hill will pick up on.
Well, I mean, I think Frank put it exactly right. It's a glimmer of hope. I'm not overly optimistic in the near term. In the longer term, I think ultimately they're going to have to figure this out, and they know it. And that's what you see, the struggle starting now, whether you talk about the president's budget, which we'll talk about a little bit later, or the House and Senate budgets and sort of where they're coming down. I mean, there is a glimmer of hope. I think that the political calculus isn't there yet for enough people to make the moves that have to be made, but I think it's moving in that direction.
Now, when I try to think optimistically about that kind of cooperation and think about it in the context of this week's events, I think about the Manchin-Toomey cooperation on gun registration background checks. And that's not an issue that we really have a lot to do with on this radio station, but it does signal at least that two people who you might not ordinarily think would cooperate with each other are willing to cooperate with each other, whatever the calculus may be. When we think about that, and we think about, as you mentioned, Stan, there is a House budget bill, there is a Senate budget bill. They don't look anything like each other, but at least there is one this year from each chamber. The president has introduced his, and as you mentioned, we'll talk about that later in the program. It just appears to me that some of the pieces that we need to put the puzzle back together are at least now on the table, where they haven't been on the table for a long time. Am I a little bit too Pollyannish about this, Frank?
I hope not. The analogy to the gun control debate is a good one, or the gun violence debate, because if you state it in theological terms, you know, no gun control is acceptable, or all guns have to be taken off the street, then we are shouting at each other. That seems not to be happening on this set of issues. And I think the potential compromise in the Senate, is a good example of how the system actually can work.
Frank Reeder's second most important federal news story of the week is from the New York Times. The headline is Lobbyists Fighting Spending Cuts Find Ally in Group That Often Backs Them. And you can read it linked up later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Stan Soloway's second most important federal news story of the week is next on the Federal News Countdown on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Your ROI by the power of three. With HP Converged Storage powered by Intel Xeon processors, you get a greater return on information, infrastructure, and individuals. HP Converged Storage is a single approach to storage that spans from entry-level to high-end systems. Its unique design delivers simplicity for any need at any scale, eliminating boundaries to transform your regular ROI into ROI to the power of three. Don't let legacy storage hold back your new application initiatives. HP Converged Storage is built for virtualization, cloud, and content-intensive environments, providing flexible capacity that outdated and siloed storage architectures just can't match. HP 3-PAR StorServe Storage balances performance and efficiency with tiered storage, improving virtualization and cloud ROI. To plan your storage strategy, begin with HP Consulting. Go to hp.com/go/federal. That's hp.com/go/federal.
Linda Curitan, CIO, NASA, commented during the panel discussion, Reimagining Government, Finding Opportunity in the Crisis.
The digital strategy is also enabling. It's not overly compliance-oriented, and it does have us look at the technologies that are so powerful today and how we can deliver that power to the mission.
To hear this show in its entirety, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword Booz Allen.
Looming budget cuts, expanded missions, greater public demand, and a changing workforce. Huge challenges for today's government agency leaders. These challenges present opportunities to maximize value and do better with less. With guidance coming from many directions, how can leaders determine what works best for their agencies? What are the game changers in the arena of driving value? And how can leaders expedite value optimization? Count on Booz Allen to help you be ready for what's next. Learn more at boozallen.com/expertvoices.
This is an important time for the federal government, a chance for agencies to do things differently. How will you help shape your future? Turn to Deloitte. With our private sector insight and public sector experience, we'll help you rethink, reduce, and restructure, and turn resolve into results, so you can see what's possible and make it happen. See how at Deloitte.com/federal. Wherever you need to go, Deloitte sees you there.
Watching What the Kids Watch. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss. With HHS HealthBeat, preschoolers can learn by watching, and a study indicates that the media their parents let them watch can influence whether they're aggressive or cooperative. At Seattle Children's Research Institute, Dimitri Christakis looked at data on 3 to 5-year-old children of 565 parents who kept track of what their kids watched. About half the parents had their kids watch programming that the researchers had vetted to emphasize nice behavior and not being aggressive. Christakis says their kids showed less aggression and more good social behavior 6 months and a year later. So he says,
one of the central findings of this study is that it should not just be about turning off the television. It should be about changing the channel.
The study in the journal Pediatrics was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
Join the Coalition for Government Procurement on April 17th for their training conference, Continuing the Dialogue, at the Crystal Gateway Marriott in Arlington, Virginia. Hear how strategic acquisition can both improve the efficiency of government and provide an opportunity for businesses to offer innovative solutions. Any government and industry professional from across the procurement community should attend this event. Don't miss this opportunity to learn and network with your colleagues from government and industry. Register now at the Coalition for Government Procurement's website, thecgp.org.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This is the Federal News Countdown with the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Frank Reeder and Stan Soloway. And Stan, your second most important federal news story of the week is from NextGov. The headline is, Report Warns of Potential Brain Drain in Federal Cyber Force. And what I took away from this was that the IT workforce in the federal government has the same kind of situation going that a lot of other aspects of the federal workforce have, which is this trough phenomenon thinned out in the 90s. And so we're going to have a lot of folks coming up on retirement, and then we're going to have a period where not as many people were hired and not as many bodies then to fill the slots of people that are retiring.
It's actually worse than that. I mean, and I think the reason I pulled this story out is a continuation of discussion that's been slowly starting, but I think has been too slow to start in the federal government. We talk a lot about the acquisition workforce, its lack of experience, and the trough that you mentioned, Francis. If you look at the IT workforce writ large and you look at the OPM data, we've got something like 77 or 78,000 people in the government who do IT, and 36,000 of them are over 50, 5,000 are under 30. So you have a 7-to-1 ratio. If you look at the cyber workforce, it's about 8-to-1. So in exactly the workforces where you'd want a dominance of younger workers, you actually have a huge retirement wave coming. And so you have this problem where, particularly with pay freezes and so forth, you get people getting close to their high three. We've seen in March, the data out of OPM was that they had four times as many retirements in March as they expected. The rate has gone up consistently the last 2 years. And here we have, not just in the cyber workforce, this is, I think, symptomatic of a broader problem, but in the broader technology workforce, an even worse problem than we have in the general workforce, in the one workforce we really need people in. The second thing I took away from this that I thought was interesting and I don't have data to compare it to what goes on in the commercial space, but I suspect I'm correct. If you look at the data in this report, the vast majority of the people in the cyber workforce had their degrees in like business administration and in management, not in technology. And if you look in the commercial world at the commercial companies that are really cutting edge, those are kids coming out of college. Those are people coming out of college with degrees in computer sciences and engineering and so forth. So there's also an interesting split here of the talent pool from which we're drawing.
Now, Frank, if I had asked Stan to pick a story that was near and dear to your heart, he couldn't have done it any better than this story, because this is something you're really passionate about.
I'm feeling chagrined that I didn't pick it myself.
Choose it yourself.
Absolutely. I'll play Pollyanna on this one a little bit. Without in any way trashing the folks who are in the eligible to or about to retire group, they have a skill set we don't need anymore. And so to some degree, this is a time of opportunity, which in fact tees up the conversation about what both of us consider to be the lead story, which is what are we doing to attract the kinds of people we need in the workforce. I mean, in a sense, while, you know, Stan's exactly right, and you said it as well, what we, and I was part of the action in 93 did with the Workforce Restructuring Act, caused this dip, this, you know, we lost a generation. Some agencies still haven't recovered from it, AID in particular. You know, as I said, at the risk of sounding like a Pollyanna, it in fact creates opportunities to attract people who have a very different skill set than the profile of the people who are leaving.
So if I take this, I don't disagree with Frank. In fact, you know, we started talking about the retirement wave back in the 90s when we saw it coming. It just was delayed. And I've always felt like that's one the greatest opportunity in generations to reshape the federal workforce. You have a passionate, committed workforce. And like in any workforce, you want to exit out the older folks and bring new ideas. Where I would go with this is a little bit less – it's not Pollyanna. I think Frank's right. This is an opportunity. The question is, and I'm very skeptical on this, whether anybody is ready to step back and look at the opportunity and really address it the way it needs to be addressed. And we're talking here about significantly restructuring and rethinking how we approach human capital in government, much like companies have had to do. You know, there are a lot of companies that didn't do it, and they are failing. There are companies that have been very successful who sort of saw the changes. And not to plug PSC, but we have a CEO commission that will report out, I hope, next month, and looking at sort of systemic barriers to efficiency and innovation in delivery. And one of the things we're looking at is the workforce challenges. And it's not just too old, too young people exiting. It wasn't just the phenomenon of the 90s. It's also, if you look at the data over the last 10 years, the number of peak career people who have left has exceeded the number who are aging out. So what does that tell you? They get to a point in their careers where they've kind of had it. And if you look at the surveys that have been done by the partnership and others, you know, there was one that just came out last week. It talks about people being very frustrated. They're the top three complaints: no reward for performance, the people next to me are not working as hard, but they make as much, if not more. Some of those dynamics that in a competitive human capital environment, which we are in the most competitive human capital environment for technology skills that we've probably ever been in, we, our companies, are not competing with the government or with the other companies for talent. What we're worried about is these people leave. They're going to the financial services industry. They're going to the utility industries. They're going elsewhere, and let alone the pure technology space, because those are markets that are booming, and there's tremendous opportunity. And until the government begins to adapt its approach to human capital in a way that makes it a much more attractive and competitive employer, the problem we're talking about is not going to solve itself. And, you know, some of this will be solved because we'll use companies more for this work. But you've got to have a core capability in the government that knows what's going on, that's contemporary. And I do have some concern whether we're going to be able to even maintain that core over a long period of time.
The good news, Frank, I think, is that I hear from HR people in government all the time that say the same thing you do, that this is a potential opportunity. So this is on people's radar screens. The issue is, can it go high enough up the chain that it gets that something really happens about it, instead of just, as your friend Alan Paller says, we're admiring the problem, but nothing ever really happens.
Right. He keeps claiming that's – no, that is his. Absolutely. I mean, two potential sources of leadership – I've got no inside information, so this is pure speculation. One would hope the CIO Council steps up to this. And we have a rather critical vacancy at OPM now. And my hope is that the administration is looking for somebody who understands exactly what Stan says, that the real – we've got to be strategic in looking at what is happening as a consequence of factors that weren't driven by human capital concerns, but that have human capital consequences.
And I just add on the opium thing. I mean, John Barry started off talking a lot about reforming HR and kind of got shot down in the system. And I'm not saying the president. I'm just saying that there was he hit a wall. He couldn't get stuff through. When I was at the Defense Department, we tried some human capital. It was actually mandated by Congress to do some significant changes to the way we managed our acquisition personnel as a pilot program. We couldn't get it off the ground because there's so many forces in the system that are opposed to that. And I'm not sure that the folks in the HR community and government are the place that this has to start. It may have to start from the operational side.
A quick plug for Stan and his organization.
Because he's very shy about doing that himself.
Yeah, I understand that. And knowing how self-effacing he and,
yes,
and PSC are.
Very reserved.
This is a roast.
Yeah. Somebody who, what we really need in the person who succeeds, John, is who understands that human capital and federal personnel are not synonymous, that it's a larger conversation about the collection of people we have, both through contractual means, especially in the IT sector, and the folks who essentially at this point are more, for the most part, contract administrators and not doers. And until we look at it from that perspective, we're going to continue to have foolishness.
We call it the whole of government. All the different players that come together to actually deliver. It's private sector, public sector, universities. It's a whole network. Steve Goldsmith calls it the government by network.
The second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Stan Soloway. Report warns of potential brain drain in federal cyber force. It's from NextGov, and you can read it linked up later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The most important federal news stories of the week is selected by Frank Reeder and Stan Soloway. We'll wrap up this week's Federal News Countdown when we come back on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
So, I got my lab results, asked my doctor a question, ordered my prescription refill, and made appointments with another specialist this morning.
That must have taken forever.
Nope. I did it all in my client's waiting room, just before the 10 o'clock meeting.
How?
Kaiser Permanente. They not only have some of the largest private multi-specialty medical groups in the world, they also have 9 million members with electronic medical records. I can get mine on my smartphone no matter where I am.
Even next week when you're in Canada?
Yep. As a Kaiser Permanente member, I can access my medical record, email my doctor's office, and make routine appointments, whether I'm in Ontario or Paris or Des Moines.
So you didn't lose your whole morning?
Not one billable minute. Kaiser Permanente has the future of healthcare figured out. It's all about connectivity, and I love it. Smartest move I ever made. Besides going to work for this firm, of course.
Kaiser Permanente. Join now and connect with a full care team from day one. Kaiser Permanente. Thrive.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
Federal News Radio is looking for your input. What do you like most about Federal News Radio 1500 AM and our website, federalnewsradio.com? Is there anything you'd like to see us do differently? We're interested in learning more about how you use our various platforms as we continue to improve them. Take our brief anonymous survey and tell us about your experience with our website and radio station. Find it online at federalnewsradio.com and be a part of making Federal News Radio work for you.
Join Federal News Radio all this week for our on-air and online series, Rise of the Money People. Financial management moves front and center as agencies make the final assault on wasted billions. We shine a brighter light on the people, their strategies, and their weapons employed that will help address wide-ranging financial challenges, sequestration among them. Rise of the Money People, all this week, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Frank Reeder and by Stan Soloway. And we're at the top of the chart.
Number one.
And both of you chose stories that were kind of along the same lines for the most important story of the week. Frank, yours is from GovExec. The headline is Obama seeks 1% pay raise for feds. And Frank, your story is Stan, I'm a little loopy from the medication.
Okay.
Your story is from the Washington Post. The headline is Obama budget raises federal worker pay and pension contributions. And The overall premise of this, of each of these stories, is how the budget request from the president will impact the federal workforce. And that actually ties to what we were just talking about a few moments ago, because while the pay raise seems to be popular, everybody likes to make more money, there's a lot of other things in this that are not very popular, Frank.
Well, and obviously the two that are not popular are, one, the increase, which over a period of 3 years will increase the employee contribution to the to FERS from 0.8% to 2%, 0.4% per year, and the other is instituting or proposing to institute the chained CPI for both federal pensions and Social Security. That's the big payoff, obviously, is in Social Security. The president's in a tough spot with respect on both subjects. One is he felt he had to give the other side something on Social Security in order to be credible in proposing tax increases. And while I think he sincerely wants to show federal employees some love, he also 1% is close to a token raise, but at least it will offset any other hits that he's asking employees to take. I don't think that this will stem the tide. The issue we were talking about earlier, looking at data years ago when this was part of my portfolio 1,000 years ago in the Ice Age, I think it was, we could actually track retirements based on how long it had been since the last major pay increase. I don't think 1% will affect anybody enough to say, gee, my high five is going to go up,
right,
or high three is going to go up significantly. So this is kind of a compromise that doesn't show the kind of love that I think we're going to have to show federal employees if we're going to make a difference.
My first thought when I saw some of these things, and my colleague Jack Moore has a story about the same issue on federalnewsradio.com, Stan, and my thought was to agree with what Frank just said, but then the other direction, I didn't see anything that I thought would make people really rush for the exits or say, boy, I'm bound and determined to stay. It seemed like it was kind of a wash.
I think a wash is a loss if you're in the federal workforce side, because there's already, I won't say a rush to the exit, but there's certainly fairly fast walking into the exits, because the point Frank just made, we talked about a little while ago, people already hitting their high three and so forth. I pulled this out not just because of the obvious of the impact on the federal workforce and so forth, because I think that's important. But I think, and Frank touched on this earlier, one of the earlier stories, or maybe when we were talking off the air, but this is another case, and this is a purely personal opinion. There's another case where we're just spending so much time debating an issue that really isn't the core question. You know, we've been making in the political debate has been federal workforce good, federal workforce bad, depending on which side you're on, and therefore they should get a raise or they shouldn't. They're either overpaid or they're not. And the reality is they're a workforce like any other workforce. They have great people, and they have some people who are not so great, and they have some people who are terrible. In some categories, the federal workforce clearly lags behind the commercial marketplace in pay. I mean, the federal employee unions have correctly made this an issue for a long time, that so-called pay gap. But that's not the core issue of where we're going with the budget. To a 1% pay raise and more pension contributions. Frankly, the Social Security piece to me is the looking at the chain CPI versus what Social Security should be 30 or 40 years from now, which is when the problem actually occurs, as opposed to what it is through the eyes of people of a certain age, whether it's Frank, who's already retired, myself, who's closer to retirement, versus my daughter, who's 24 years old and who has 40 years to worry about these things and might have a different contract with the government. So the aperture is so narrow in the discussion. What struck me here is Joe Davidson writes about the federal workforce, and that's clearly why it's his article, but there has been so much talk about this. A, I think it is going to perpetuate a human capital problem, and B, once again, we're turning our attention to the wrong issues.
There's a passage in Stan's story, Frank, that I think gets at the heart of this, and I don't think gets nearly enough attention. Greg Juneman, president of the International Federation of Professional Technical Engineers, who's been a guest on this program, Joe Davidson quotes him as saying, "Taxpayers don't want the cheapest federal employees they can find." I don't understand why that viewpoint doesn't get presented a lot more often, because that, I think, is a terrific place to start an argument.
It is, but I think typically this issue is framed in terms of the theological debate we referred to earlier, mm-hmm. which is supporting pay for federal employees is seen as, that tax and spend, big government view rather than dealing it in a much more granular, rational fashion. But let me argue against what I said earlier.
Please feel free.
Which is, in my experience, most of the folks that I've worked with over the years are drawn to the public sector because of the work that they're allowed to do, the privilege of being, A, being able to serve the public, and B, doing what is very often the most challenging work, whether it's policy or technical. It is – the message here, I think, is less an economic message than it is an emotional message, and that's the part of it that bothers me that's a little bit mixed.
The sentiment that's going on in the workforce, I think, is summed up pretty well in Frank's story, Stan. This story from GovExec quotes Carl Goldman, executive director of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. While the president's proposal for a 1% pay increase for federal workers is better than a pay freeze, I don't feel like jumping and shouting for joy. That seems to be the sentiment that we're hearing a lot about this.
Yeah, I think it's all tied together in a broader whole. It's not just about pays. For a lot of federal employees, particularly those doing the kinds of missions that Frank was referring to, it's not all about pay, otherwise they wouldn't be there. But you have to put the whole package together. Go back to what we were talking about a minute ago about the cyber workforce or the IT workforce or other workforce issues. Where what are we seeing cut in the budget right and left? Training, development. The whole question of whether the workforce feels rewarded for high performance, which anybody would want in any environment. And you look across in the analytical, what do they call it? The analytical part of the report of the president's budget. There's a whole section on the federal workforce, and they talk about this, you know, leadership development. I think there are 45 people in the leadership development program, and it's expected to go to 150, which it was only one program. It's not the whole government. My point is it should be thousands. It shouldn't be 45 or 50 or 100. Just, again, goes back to the point I made before. I think it just buttresses this concern that we're focused here about nits and nets, about whether we're raising pay, which is critically important to the people on the front line. I get that, particularly with some furloughs still potential. But we're missing how we develop, how we target, how we think about the total workforce, the whole of government, as Frank was talking about a little while ago, and what the right collection, connection, and intersection of them all is. And that just seems to go right by the boards. It's maybe too high a level for the politics, but it's ultimately how an organization functions. Every organization does this if they're good.
The most important federal news stories of the week on this week's Federal News Countdown for both Frank Reeder and Stan Soloway are surrounding the release of the fiscal 2014 budget request, and you can find those stories later today. FederalNewsRadio.com/in-depth. We'll talk more about them when we come back on the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose in just a minute.
Start here at Optimos. We envision America having confidence in their government to provide quality services at the right price. We believe government contractors are part of the solution. In nearly two decades serving the federal government, Optimos has learned that smaller, smarter, faster, cheaper services and solutions can help make that vision a reality. Innovation should be incremental, configurable, quick, and affordable. And it should provide sustainable value to the government and the taxpayer. Smaller, smarter, faster, cheaper. It's how we think. It's what we do. Learn more at Optimos.com.
Did you know that organ and tissue transplants save thousands of lives each year? Make the decision to save lives by becoming an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Registering is easy. Do it whenever obtaining or renewing your driver's license. Or register online at beadonor.org. That's beadonor.org. This is Hillary Howard. I registered to be a donor and have the heart on my driver's license to prove it. Join me and register today.
And now the Federal Living Report, brought to you by WEPA.
More women and minorities are joining the senior executive service ranks in government. Women now account for 33% of the 8,000 SESers. That's up from 32% in 2011, according to an annual report from the Office of Personnel Management. The number of African Americans and Asians also grew year over year. However, the number of Latinos dropped slightly. The Defense Department has the most SES employees, followed by Justice, Homeland Security, Treasury, and the Energy Department.
The start of a new year is one of the best times to review the state of your financial affairs. Unfortunately, many individuals overlook one of the most important aspects of their financial plan, life insurance. WEPA, a nonprofit association, enables federal employees to purchase better life insurance at far better prices. As a superior alternative or supplement to FEGLI, WEPA provides more coverage, more benefits, and greater flexibility, yet costs much less. Visit WAEPA.org to learn more.
The 2013-14 season ticket deposit campaign is on now.
Obviously, it's one of the hottest tickets in town.
Full season ticket deposits are $250 per seat.
Puck fired.
They score!
You don't want to miss the 2013-14 Caps team in action.
It's hard to beat the atmosphere here. It's rocking and rolling.
Do your part in building America's hockey capital. Call 202-266-CAPS or log on to WashingtonCaps.com for more information.
Sequestration is here, and federal leaders are facing a perfect storm of public scrutiny, increased pressure to perform, and reduced budgets. At Excellence in Government on May 13th and 14th, they will convene federal leaders, managers, and government performance stakeholders at this free educational event to learn the key tactics needed to succeed in today's environment. Join federal colleagues May 13th and 14th in Washington, D.C. to get the ideas you need now to drive high-performance government. Learn more at excellenceingov.com.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week with the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Frank Reeder and by Stan Soloway. And the most important stories from each of them have to do with the fiscal 2014 budget request. Stan chose Joe Davidson's story in the Washington Post, headlined "Obama Budget Raises Federal Worker Pay and Pension Contributions." And Frank chose the GovExec story, "Obama Seeks 1% Pay Raise for Feds." But Frank, you mentioned during the commercial break that there's something underlying here that you think is worthy of paying attention to also.
Well, or maybe what's not underlying this, which is even more troublesome, and namely, you know, we keep focusing on what I see as the margins. Even the proposal to reduce both federal employee retirement and Social Security by moving from the I guess it's CPIW to the chain CPI avoids the essential problem, which is healthcare costs. And I don't mean healthcare financing. This is not about Obamacare. They are driving the fiscal problem. They are, whether we want to use dramatic terms like fiscal cliff or not, pushing us. And nowhere are we dealing with that except by arbitrarily placing ceilings on growth, which don't solve any problem at all.
And that gets at what you've been saying throughout the course of the program, Stan, which is we're nibbling around the edges and not really getting at the heart of the problem.
Yeah, I think even on the healthcare question, as I look at this, and it's clearly this, what we have is a philosophical debate here, and this budget, when they talk about reducing spending, the civilian spending cuts don't come for 3 or 4 years, or 2 or 3 years anyway. They're down the road. So they're out years. Reductions. I'm not sure how much credibility that will have in this. I mean, that's what every administration does. Is we always put everything to the out years to fix whatever problem we have. So you've got delayed spending reductions, and even on the healthcare side, it's an interesting debate's going to evolve. I think at least on the House side, because that's the excuse the Defense Department is using. And I don't mean to suggest that I don't think they're right. When I say excuse, it's not a judgment, but that's the reason they're giving for doing the same thing to military pay, requiring a higher contribution to TRICARE and so forth, is the spiraling cost of military health care. But the Republican leadership on the House Armed Services Committee is going to come at that really hard and argue that that's actually a false, that the data's wrong, that in fact military health care is not going up any faster than any other element of the budget. And so you're going to start getting back into a debate. You know, a year ago or 2 years ago, it was an article of faith. Healthcare is just skyrocketing out of control. Now we're seeing that debate come back. So I think we're seeing some old debates come back in this process that really is where we have to ultimately get you away from nibbling around the edges and back to the core philosophical question. Is this a stimulus budget or is it a deficit reduction budget? What's the first? What's the second thing we do? I'm not proposing any solution, but I think you start seeing these other debates. And the last I'll point out is the increasing talk we've heard the last several months that the deficit's not the bigger problem. where it's that we don't have to, we're worrying too much about the deficit and not enough about growth. That debate, you know, for several years was, oh my God, the deficit's $1 trillion plus. Now it's, well, there's elements saying, well, you know, relative to GDP, it's not that big a problem. That's not the most critical thing we face. So we're kind of going full circle in the debates in some sense.
How much of that conversation, Frank, do you think is leadership? Because if you boil it down to the military health care debate, that conversation that Stan was talking about started when Bob Gates said military health care costs are eating us alive and used that exact term. Now that he's not been in office for a period of time, I'm not saying that those two things are tied together, but it is a coincidence. It could be a coincidence that people are now starting to trend away from that the way that Stan's talking about. But I imagine there's some connection to the way that dialogue started originally. And I wonder if that same concept doesn't apply to the broader budget conversation.
Let's see. Let me unpack the question. It is, in the final analysis, I would argue, a leadership problem. Maybe putting it in slightly sexist term, a statesmanship problem. And both sides of are equally culpable on this one. We can continue as we did in the sequestration psychodrama to play what Aaron Moldovsky used to call the Washington Monument game. And it was utterly bizarre what the administration did by way of overly dramatizing the effect of sequestration rather than dealing with it seriously. And the other side is equally culpable. So, I think it is a leadership problem. Going back to our earlier conversation, my hope is, and maybe it's a faint hope, that folks are willing to start to talk seriously rather than toss grenades.
Stan, I have to say something that is just going to break your heart. Frank gets the last word today. It's a pleasure to have both of you gentlemen on the program. It always is. Stan Soloway, the Professional Services Council, and Frank Reeder, Center for Internet Security. Thank you both for being on the program. The most important federal news story of the week for Frank Reeder is from GovExec, Obama seeks 1% pay raise for feds. Stan's most important story is from the Washington Post. The headline is Obama budget raises federal worker pay and pension contributions. You can find all the stories that we counted down later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And hour number two of In-Depth with Francis Rose coming in a minute on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.